Good morning, everyone. This is the portion of Westchester on the Levels time that we refer to as the Constitution today. My name is Jeffrey Swartz, and I'm here with my colleague, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at the WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. And I'm supposed to say the following, and that is that the things that Brendan and myself say during the course of this hour are our opinions and are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty as a whole. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you today?
Oh, there you are. Okay, you're there. Okay. good morning. It's a wonderfully cloudy, muggy, awful, oppressive day down in Florida. I hope your weather is better wherever you are than those of you who are listening. It's just been that way here this summertime in Florida, the land of milk and honey and humidity. We start each. I'm sure that was real popular with the economics people down here. Chamber of Commerce people. Yeah, I'm sure that was real popular with them.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't actually beat probably the worst I ever heard Chamber of Commerce statement before. And that was many years ago when my friend Marilyn Million, who actually was a judge in Miami, became the judge on the People's Court. And her first case was over a road rage case. And somewhere along the line, she interrupted whoever was talking and said, "Road rage, that's not road rage. I'm from Miami. We shoot people over parking spaces." Okay. That was her very first show. And she got like 60 letters from all the different chambers of commerce around the Miami-Dade County area. She had to write apology letters and all that kind of stuff. So I don't feel bad. I'm sure that Ron DeSantis is not really paying attention to me right now, so I don't care. I really don't care. Okay. We start out the show both of us having the opportunity to say what we really think. Today, what I really think is not an anger. It's more of a congratulations to the people of the state of Wisconsin. This past weekend, Ron, I don't know what I'm saying at any one moment, but I know it's bad. Johnson showed up, the senator from Wisconsin, showed up at a rally for Juneteenth Day. And proceeded to make it sound like he was all in favor of Juneteenth and he was in favor of voters' rights and all in for the African-American community, which we know was in and of itself a lie, when he was surrounded by members of the people that were at this Juneteenth booing him, telling him to leave, "We don't want you here," and calling him out. And what Senator Johnson found out the hard way, and probably is finding out even the harder way, and in a moment I'll describe how, that there are consequences for being either the moron that you are or the disingenuous, rabble-rousing, troublemaking, not good trouble, right-wing nut. Either one of those fits his description, and he's finding out there's consequences for it. He is way down in the polls. Even Republicans in that state want somebody else to run for the United States Senate, and I believe that he's under a great deal of pressure to not run for a third term based upon pressure from the Senate Republican Senate Campaign Committee, which is headed up by Rick Scott, formerly the incompetent governor of the state of Florida, now the incompetent senator from the state of Florida, who is in control of that committee on behalf of Mitch McConnell. And I have to believe that he's being told, "You're not going to get a whole lot of money from us. We'd really rather you did not run. We need to hold on to your seat. You're a loser. All the things that go with it. The problem is I don't know where Ron Johnson would go if he didn't have a United States Senate seat. So I kind of, at this point, want to congratulate the people of the state of Wisconsin, especially those who made it abundantly clear that Senator Johnson is no longer welcome and they don't want him around and booing him in front of a large crowd of people. And I think that they're coming about probably going to make themselves a correct choice, whatever that choice may be. Let's just say 80% would be better than Ron Johnson. There is a 20% that could be worse. But anything to me would seem to be better. So congratulations to the state of Wisconsin and its people. And that's what I think.
All right. Wow. Starting off on a quasi-positive note, that's good. Refreshing.
It doesn't happen very often.
No. And I've got sort of a glass half full, glass half empty opening thought as well. I thought I would comment on the recently concluded first trip overseas of President Joe Biden. And, you know, as always, people might ask, what does this have to do with the Constitution? Hang in there. I'm going somewhere with this. The President of the United States and the constitutional hook here is that I want to quote the Supreme Court on the role of the President of the United States that under Article 2 of the Constitution. The Supreme Court has said, quote, the President of the United States is the face of the United States to the world, which I think is something that people need to consider when they cast a vote for President of the United States. Whenever I would say that to people during the Trump presidency, you could sort of see thoughts flickering. Really? Donald Trump is the face of the United States to the world? And the answer is absolutely yes. As long as Donald Trump's the president, he was the face of the United States to the world. So what are we showing the world? Are we showing the world ugliness? And I don't mean physically, obviously. I mean, vulgarity, crassness, cruelty, ignorance. Is that what we're showing the world? Or are we showing the world compassion, power through example, the best that a democratic republic can offer, which obviously is not perfect? Which face are we showing to the world? And I would suggest that face has changed dramatically. The good news was, I don't know about you, but I was able to sit back, watch Air Force One land in a foreign country, that magnificent aircraft, and not be utterly mortified at the person who was about to walk out of that aircraft in front of the world. It was really nice to be able to do that. So that was the good news. And I think he was well received. I think Biden was well received. I think he did a good job representing the values of the United States. I thought he was tough, as tough as he had to be without being, going overboard. I thought that he made it clear that Russia is dealing with a different player here. So all that was good. The bad was, and this was, it's hard to pinpoint anything concrete here, but there was this undercurrent in the reporting and in the responses that you could see of foreign leaders of distrust, but not distrust of Joe Biden. For a long time now, I've been likening the relationship between the United States and the rest of the free world to sort of a marriage. And what happened under Donald Trump was, so we elected a president who what had no use for NATO, had no use for alliances at all, who openly embraced foreign autocrats and authoritarian leaders. So I mean, he was, you know, he was, and especially the anti-NATO part obviously stuck in the craw of many European leaders. And as Jeff, as you and I have said on this program a few times, the problem is that Trump voters didn't vote for Trump despite all of that, despite his crass and vulgar goings-on and musings. They didn't vote for him despite that. They voted for him because of it.
That's true.
And that was, yeah, and that was the face we showed to the world. And so there is distrust. And the distrust is not of Joe, as I said, it's not of Joe Biden. It's of the almost 80 million people who voted to put Donald Trump back in the White House after 4 years of this disaster that he oversaw, not just in foreign policy, but in one of the most worst bungled health crises in the history of the United States. And so I look at it, and I'm curious to see what you think of this kind of analogy, this metaphor. I look at it as the rest of the world, it seemed to me when Biden was overseas, that the rest of the world was collectively saying to us, okay, we'll stay married, but you cheated on us. And so we can put this, you know, in a marriage, if one of the spouses cheats on the other one, you can keep the marriage together, right? I mean, theoretically, that's possible. You can decide you're going to work on it, you're going to move forward, you're going to keep it together, but you're never going to be able to forget. And you're never going to quite be able to trust again the way that you did before. And that was the sense I got out of this, was our partners in the world have agreed that we can work on this relationship, that the United States should maintain its role in the world, but that there is just this underlying something has happened, a bell that you cannot unring, and I think the world remains shaken. And one of the reasons is another thing we've talked about here, that despite Joe Biden winning the popular vote by 7 million votes, he came within 40,000 votes in three states combined of losing the election. And now we have Republicans in
yeah,
the system, you know,
yeah,
where they can take it the next time. So that's what I think.
Well, that's one of the things that bothers the other democracies. It is a direct democracy as it relates to the election of their leaders, even though they have representatives in a legislature or a parliament.
Right.
As far as the leaders are concerned, it's a direct vote. It's a direct democracy. In the United States, we don't have a direct democracy as it relates to our leaders of our country. We have, again, a form of representative democracy where we elect certain people to vote on our behalf. And it used to be that those people would vote however they wanted to. And they were elected. Not a vote for the presidential candidate. But now we've reduced it. We have, with the Constitution, taken away even that semblance of independence and tried to make it a direct democracy by claiming that people are required to vote or placing restraints upon the freedom of the electors to exercise their discretion. And because of that, in having seen how that system is manipulated to maintain minority rule on a number of occasions, it is one of those things where other countries just don't understand why it is that people elected that way. They don't understand why Hillary Clinton wasn't president of the United States. They don't understand how George Bush got elected president of the United States in the first place.
Right.
They lost, and they don't
right.
understand how you lose, but you win. And so that part of the system has always been a problem for them. Now they have the problem of we elected someone like Donald Trump. It is not the first time that we have elected an incompetent person or a populist to the presidency. The first one that obviously you can look at is Andrew Jackson, and you can look at others ever since. Other populists have been wholly unsuccessful, like William Jennings Bryan. We talked about it early this morning, three strikes and you're out. He ran three times. One time he didn't make it to the national ballot. Two times he did, and both those times he got himself handled rather easily. We have seen other populists. We have seen bad presidents. The problem is that none of them have ever gone to the extent of attempting to destroy American democracy like Donald Trump did. So with that said, I can understand. Yes, to me, I agree with you. It is one of those things, like a marriage, I guess you could say. You know, we're going to work things out. We're going to stay together. We're going to do all those things. But I'm going to be watching. And that is a trust issue. There's an old expression that says you can spend a lifetime building up trust, and it can take you one moment to lose it.
Right.
And you may never get it back again.
That's right.
And I will tell you that our ability to get it back will be spoken of in 2022, and it will be spoken of in 2024.
Right.
And if the fragility of our democracy continues the way that it is, other countries are going to start saying, you know, we got to really start planning for the day when
right.
the United States isn't going to be there for us.
Mm-hmm.
So how the 2022 elections come out, how 2024 results, is going to tell a lot about how the world is going to think about the United States of America.
Right.
And that's how you build trust. If this road that we started on last year continues within the far right, and we cannot find some way of suppressing it, and I don't mean suppressing it in the legal sense that we're trying to drive them out, but suppressing it by providing and delivering to the people and taking their anger away and having them say just the simple statement, why am I looking a gift horse in the mouth? That is, I have things are good for me, things are better for me. Why would I look that gift horse in the mouth? That's how you win the people back. You win the people back, you win the world back. It's just that simple. And I agree with you. We're not on thin ice, but it's thinning all the time.
Right, right.
I agree with that. So you have a legitimate point there, a very good point.
Well, thank you.
How about that? Every once in a while, you get lucky. Okay.
You know, twice a day, like a clock, right?
Yeah, really. It's a red letter day. Let's write this one down. It's like Juneteenth.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to bring out some. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but I'd really like to talk about this a little bit. I did a little bit more research into it. Yesterday, I received an email from the person who's in charge of PR for the school where we work, and he passes on media requests for comments, and that's where Brendan and I do a lot of work, either in television or in newsprint, providing answers to people in the media who want comment and information regarding any one particular issue. Yesterday, without knowing why this came out, a news request came out from Newsmax in New York. They summarized the request that they were sending out is, can prosecutorial discretion can become, and I don't understand, can prosecutorial discretion can become prosecutorial abuse? Obviously, we need to do a little bit more proofreading before we send things out. And I won't name the person who sent it out because that's not necessary. But here was the query, as they put it, query, okay? It says, as New York City announces it will drop most rioting and looting charges against people involved in incidents last summer, where buildings were destroyed and merchandise stolen, prosecutors are moving full steam ahead, charging people in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th with few plea deals. Looking to compare / contrast how prosecutors are handling the two different incidents. Is this unfair? Are people who entered the Capitol and did not destroy property being treated unfairly while people who did destroy property get off scot-free? And the requirements for answering were you either had to be a legal expert, a lawyer, which I think is an oxymoron, law professors, or federal prosecutors. Okay? So I rendered an answer, but let me tell you first, I finally found out where this all came from. Apparently yesterday, on Sunday, one of the guests or one of the hosts at Newsmax was interviewing one of our favorite New York City police officer, New Hampshire police officers, turned somehow a great political mind and basic person who was as responsible as any for Donald Trump ever becoming president of the United States, which is not a credit. Okay. Corey Lewandowski was being interviewed, and they were talking about the fact that here are all these multi-hundreds of people who were yanked off the street because they were misbehaving. Some of them may have destroyed property. Some of them may have stolen property. Some of them may have just been in the area and were getting arrested for unlawful assembly, where there had or a violation of the curfew, anything that would get them off the street. Their charges are being dismissed. And Lewandowski goes crazy and says, why aren't they looking at all the video and why aren't they doing facial recognition? Because they're not the federal government. Because they don't have access to all of those things. Because maybe they're not even seen in any of it. Maybe there wasn't even a body cam. I don't know. But that's not the reason why they're being let go and other people aren't being charged or being charged and chased. Somehow, for some reason, I found it necessary to write them the following response. There is a major difference between minor offenses revolving around property damage and actions taken with or without property damage intended to interrupt and prevent lawful action by the government of the United States under the Constitution. In other words, insurrection. You are conflating decisions made by a local prosecutor with decisions made by the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney for a specific district. Different jurisdictions and different seriousness. Community standards come into play. Is it fair? It might not be. But fairness is not the issue. The issue may simply be efficiency of the system and seriousness of the crimes. Issues which prosecutors deal with all the time. Nothing is done in a vacuum. This is not prosecutorial abuse. Prosecutorial abuse is when you go after people who don't deserve to be gone after. That's prosecutorial abuse. And mostly in this situation, the idea that anyone would conflate violating a curfew or unlawful assembly, or throwing a brick through a window, or maybe stealing a pack of gum, with the idea of overthrowing the government of the United States, lives in that vacuum and is looking for reason to somehow say the government is prosecuting people who are on the right side of the political spectrum, which, of course, we know Newsmax is. This was a supposed news agency just looking for people to tell them their rights. That's all they were looking for.
Right, right.
And you can, and I can, let me tell you something. I learned a long time ago. You can find an expert who will say what you want them to say. You may have to search far and wide, but you can always find some guy for money who will say what you want them to say. I learned that through expert witnesses. I was an expert
yep.
witness. I wasn't one of those expert witnesses, but I was an expert witness. But you can find someone. There were times people consulted me. I told them what they didn't want to hear, and I never heard from them again.
Mm-hmm.
What a
You'll
surprise.
Never hear from Newsmax again either. See, that was...
And I don't care. My standards of caring about things have really lessened over the years. They haven't gotten greater. They're lesser.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay. You know, I've learned to set aside some of this stuff. So I just wanted to bring this out. I mean, I just, you know, I found out what really was going on behind this. And,
yeah.
You know, if I'm never on Newsmax, you know, I'll be better off for it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I got a couple points on that. I'm glad you raised that because that's really interesting to talk about. My first reaction is the irony of a right-leaning outfit like that asking about prosecutorial abuse on the heels of all the revelations that we're seeing now about the way the last administration used the Department of Justice. You know, it's the very definition of at least abuse of power. So there's the irony of it. There's also, you know, and this is a real problem in our country and has been for a very long time, is the persistent use of logical fallacies in public discourse. And there are two things going on there with this effort to, and of course, you know, all you hear is Antifa, 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 right? I'm surprised I didn't put that in their query, you know.
Which isn't a real organization, people.
That's right.
There's no governing body of Antifa.
Right.
It's sort
right.
of a loose-knit
right.
conglomeration of liberal, anti-fascist groups. But there's no
right.
big head of it. It's not like the Oath Keepers, okay?
Right, right. Yeah, and it's not coordinated. And So we have an insurrection, as you point out, and people on the right immediately default to these two fallacies. The first is simply what I call whataboutism, which is just change the subject. Okay, so we have hundreds of people in the Capitol trying to bring down the Republic, but you know, let's talk about Antifa and property damage instead. So first of all, you know, the tact here is to change the subject. Then, having said, let's not talk about the issue that's in front of us, let's talk about something else, the next step in this two-step of fallacies is false equivalence, is to suggest that one is the same as the other. They're of equal gravity. So you see both of those going on here. The third point I'd make is, and this is going to sound kind of ethereal and, you know, pie in the sky, but... You know, once you identify the fallacies, let's talk about how, you know, what is legitimate reasoning? What is strong reasoning? We do a few different kinds of reasoning, and this is something we obviously train lawyers to do. One is inductive, which is sort of the process of discovering and observing and finding rules to apply. The other is deductive, where you apply rules to a set of facts, where you apply accepted standards to a set of facts to reach a conclusion. So you don't just reason from the gut. We actually have standards and rules and facts and evidence, and these are the things that we use. The third is, and this is very commonly used by lawyers, is analogical reasoning, which is comparing one thing to another and doing it using common sense and common knowledge. And it is just breathtaking to me that somebody could compare, as you said, Jeff, a minor property crime to, you know, look, if there were people who misbehaved in, I don't know, in Portland, in New York, in anywhere, any other city in the United States, okay, that was not something I was watching on television wondering whether my country would survive. And so to suggest an equivalence between inflicting property damage and bringing down the republic, as I said, is absolutely breathtaking. These people could not have gotten past the Sesame Street game. Which one of these things is not like the others? You remember that? They'll show you a glove, a sock,
yep,
a shoe,
yep,
and a hamburger, right?
Right.
And any three-year-old can tell you, oh, the hamburger doesn't quite fit. So whoever wrote that query, I don't think got past Sesame Street in terms of their ability to reason their way through a problem. So sorry to go on there, but it's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I agree, and that's why I wrote back. I mean, it's not a difficult issue to deal with unless you've already made up your mind. I tell people all the time, and I've told you this, that I teach at a law school, and I look at people, and sometimes in decisions that, especially in criminal procedure, when we talk about the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, someone will say, well, that doesn't seem very fair. And I have to look at them and say, let me make something clear to you because you're going to become a lawyer. Fairness is never the issue. Fairness is the law is not fair. And if you're going into the law because you want to deal with fairness, you're going into the wrong business, because to half of the people, remembering we have an adversarial system here, winners and losers, right? Half the people believe the law is unfair when they walk out of a courtroom.
Right.
That's the way it works. So please don't operate on the idea of what is or is not fair. The law is not always fair, and I point to landlord-tenant laws all the time. Landlord-tenant laws are absolutely passed by a legislature in favor of landlords.
Right.
Absolutely. And I used to get people in front of me saying, Judge, you can't throw me out of my apartment. I've lived there for 20 years. Now they're throwing me out. I don't know where I'm going to go. And I say, well, I'm sorry, but they own the property, and they don't want you as a tenant anymore. But, Judge, that's not fair. There must be something that will keep me there. And I look at them and say, who owns that property? And they say, the landlord. And I got to say, it's their property. It may not seem fair to you, but that's what the law says. And I don't have any choices because that's the way the law is written. So fairness is not the issue. And when you start talking about fair, you know that something's coming up to conflate your problem with somebody else's. Well, your problem isn't that somebody else's. It's your problem. And we judge your problem against the law, not your problem against somebody else's problem.
Right.
Okay? So that's kind of the way that it goes. So
You got caught speeding, right? And you say to the cop, well, you didn't get the other two people who were speeding too. And the cop says, well, I got you.
That's right.
I got you.
God knows the number of times the cops hear that. Wait a minute, what are you stopping me for? Why don't you stop the car that was passing me? Because I wasn't looking at him. I was looking at you.
Right.
Because you drive a red car, and I like red cars.
Right.
Okay, that happens to be not true. Red cars do not get the most speeding tickets. White cars do.
Is that right?
That may be because there's
an urban
more
legend.
White cars on the road. What?
It's an urban legend, the red car thing.
Yeah, it is an urban. It's a legend. And most legends are not based in fact. Okay, yeah. I don't think Davy Crockett killed him a bar when he was only three. Okay, so... Okay, so it's not based in fact, okay? One of the other things we wanted to talk about, and I think we should talk about some law stuff for a while, A number of decisions came out of the U.S. Supreme Court, the most important of which may be that it was the decision regarding the Affordable Care Act, muchly a surprise at 7-2, and deciding that they really didn't decide anything constitutional.
Right.
They dodged that bullet by basically saying you don't have standing. In other words, you, state of Texas, and all the others that joined you have not been damaged as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Therefore, not being damaged, you don't have a cognizable claim against the ACA. The basis of the claim by Texas and the other states were that it was costing them money to administer the ACA. The evidence basically belied that because they get they had Medicare expansion available to them, which would have paid all administrative costs and other reasons for providing this expanded Medicare. The states who chose not to accept that can't claim that they were damaged because they had the choice. And there were all kinds of other reasons spouted out there, but the bottom line was that even with Amy Coney Barrett, who very honestly has written numerous articles against the ACA and its unconstitutionality, voted with the majority, they're basically saying it's the law of the land, don't bother us anymore.
Right. Yeah, the tone and of the opinion
the
was,
word is out.
Was exasperated.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
They
were very exasperated.
Yeah.
I think Roberts, this shows you the power of John Roberts.
Right.
To me, this shows you that John Roberts is, to a great degree, in control of this court.
Mm-hmm.
When he can pull Amy Coney Barrett in, okay, and he can pull in Brett Kavanaugh, people who clearly politically don't like the ACA because they are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, the practicality portion of it being 10 years old, people, 31 million people depending upon it, the vast majority of Americans being in favor of the ACA, and there being no reasonable alternative, and that the end result is insurance companies will make 10 times the profits they do now, those things were practical approaches, and they were pragmatic. And I think that drew them in, and I think that's Roberts more than anybody else. I was surprised at Gorsuch being on the other side. I really was.
Yeah. And Thomas
I wasn't
being
surprised
with
Sam Alito's. What?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And Thomas being with Roberts, that was a surprise too.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I think Thomas abdicated his role of the leader of the right and conceded the post-Scalia leadership of that wing of the court to Sam Alito,
mm-hmm.
who's going to go nowhere. Okay? No chance will ever be rid of Alito. He's too young in the first place. He's still in his 60s.
Yeah.
But, no. I think that is really the end result here.
Yeah.
The end result here is that Thomas is not going to be the leader of the right wing of the party. It's going to be Sam Alito, or the court. It's going to be Sam Alito.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of thought of that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you're right. I mean, they didn't. Everybody was expecting a decision on the merits. Right. I mean, and instead we got a standing decision. Which I guess
suppose in a that's all they had to do.
Yeah, that's what severability,
yeah, severability.
And we thought that was going to be, the opinion. But in a technical sense, standing is a constitutional issue, as the court noted under Article 3, courts can only hear federal courts can only hear cases and controversies. And it's interesting too, the way Republicans in the Congress orchestrated this kind of came back to bite them. Just to remind people, I think we talked about it last week, but what happened here was that the Affordable Care Act, and in particular the mandate, the individual mandate under the Affordable Care Act, was upheld by the Supreme Court years ago as a valid use of Congress's power to tax. And the court said that was the only justification Congress could use to enact the individual mandate. And the reason the court said it was a valid tax is that it ran through the IRS and it generated revenue for the federal treasury, and therefore it's a valid tax. But the court said if it was not a valid tax, it wouldn't be valid at all. So then what happens? Donald Trump gets elected. Republicans take control of both houses of Congress. And what do? They zeroed out the tax, right, the penalty for not having insurance. So, and then go back to court and say, well, now look what we did. You, the Supreme Court, said that this thing was only valid because it was a revenue-raising measure, right, and a tax. Now we've taken away the tax. We've zeroed it out. So now you have to say it's not constitutional anymore. The problem is that to have standing to sue in federal court, you have to have suffered an injury. And I thought one of the most entertaining and amusing parts of the court's discussion here, per Justice Breyer, was, again, this exasperated question. You know, it comes down to this. Can somebody explain to us, says the court, can somebody please explain to us who is injured by a penalty of zero, by an unenforceable part of a law that's been zeroed out? Who's hurt by that? Nobody has to pay the penalty. Because there were individual plaintiffs, in this case as well, and the court just kind of throwing its arms up and saying, whoop. So it was clever of them to zero it out so they can make the argument that it's not a valid tax anymore. But by zeroing it out, they ensure that nobody's injured. Nobody can claim any kind of an injury. So that came back to bite them here. And so interesting little dynamic.
I think one of the keys also was, I thought it was also important that basically they were saying, how can you claim that the law doesn't work without the penalty when the law is working?
Yes, right, right. Right. Without
where
the
is your evidence that it doesn't work? Okay.
Right. Right. Right.
Show me some evidence. You know.
Right.
Show me the money. Okay.
Right. Which just goes to show you. They weren't. They weren't really. Republicans were not after the penalty or the individual mandate. That's not. They wanted the whole thing gone. They wanted insurance companies to be able to deny you for pre-existing conditions. You can get thrown off your parents', insurance plans. You can face lifetime caps. You can be dropped if you get sick. That's what they were after. They were after the whole thing. They didn't want to say it, right? They don't want to admit that those are the things they're after because those are popular things. But that would have been the result.
Yeah. So the law works. It's been working. It's been with us for 10 years. It's going to be with us until it actually changes for the better. They're basically just saying, don't bother us anymore.
Right.
Don't bother us, okay?
Right.
Because we're not going to take any more of these. Enough's enough. Three strikes and you're out. And this is strike three.
Right.
Okay, and they can argue with the ump, but the ump's just basically said, I'm throwing you out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can't argue balls and strikes. You're out, okay?
Right.
So, okay, hate to use a baseball metaphor, but, boy, it really works, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
One of the other decisions that came down was a decision involving the NCAA. Now, for those of you who don't know what this is about, basically what happened here is that a player for the Ohio State Buckeyes, go Bucks, I am an Ohio State graduate, who was a quarterback, last name was Pryor, got suspended and not allowed to play which basically destroyed, by the way, his ability to be the quarterback at Ohio State, because another quarterback stepped in and, by the name of Haskins and took over the job. And he had to come back and play wide receiver. He actually ended up in the NFL playing wide receiver, but claimed that he was substantially damaged by the actions of the NCAA with his prospective and damages that he suffered because of the suspension. What he did was something that's not allowed. He made money off of his own name. He sold his national championship ring because he needed money. He sold at least one, maybe more, of his game jerseys with an autograph on it to make money. And because he desperately needed another tattoo, okay, he got a discount on a tattoo, which, because he received a discount that others don't get, was considered to be remuneration. And he sued. And he sued the NCAA and said, you are in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. You can't stop me and punish me as an organization because of this. Now, a lot of things came out of this lawsuit, which are truths that I think all of us can accept. I won't go to the main opinion. I'm going to go to the concurring opinion by Justice Kavanaugh, who I'm not a big fan of, but wrote the following. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. And under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be different. He said their business model, the NCAA's business model, in any other business in the United States would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. Now, what's this about? This is about not millions of dollars, not hundreds of millions of dollars, but tens of billions of dollars that the NCAA and the schools that belong to the NCAA garner off of the fruits, as fruits of the labor of others who get a scholarship to go to college and that's all, who do a job every day of the week, and that includes in the off season when they're in a weight room, when they're taking care of themselves, when they're running patently illegal practices among themselves. People who are playing for the hope of getting drafted into the NFL, of which only 250-some per year actually do. And they make this money. Now, does some of it go to good purposes? Yes. At Ohio State University, the football program supports every other sport, men or women's sport, that they put on. And it provides all the facilities that are needed. The travel money, the uniforms, all of that's paid for by the football program, which makes, I don't even want to estimate how many tens of millions of dollars of profit a year. And the NCAA makes money. But here's the real kicker. And this was pointed out to by the majority. Coaches who coach football in particular at major schools, make anywhere from $5 to $11 million a year, and their players make nothing. And they treat these people basically like unpaid employees. They control their futures. They control their playing time. They punish those who don't do things their way and diminish their potential earning capacity in the future, talented or not. But the players make nothing. In many cases, can't afford to even feed themselves because they don't have parents who somehow come up with money through other auspices to give them a leg up, to buy them a car or give them an apartment to live in. And they're not even allowed to take a job at a booster. Those are people who give money to the school, okay, if they're not really working. And giving them that job in and of itself may be buying their services as a football player. You can't even sign an autograph for money. Your face belongs to them. Your name belongs to them. And Gorsuch wrote, in the majority opinion, the NCAA rules depress compensation for at least some student athletes below what a competitive market would yield. According to the NCAA, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit got it wrong when it issued an injunction holding the organization's requirement for student athletes to agree on a broad non-compensation provisions violated antitrust law. So now these student athletes, football or otherwise, have the right to obtain additional education-related compensation. That's the way they put it. I mean, they don't even provide health care to these student athletes. They don't provide pharmaceutical help. They don't, you know, so now they could call into question collaborations and joint ventures now that would provide those things, information technology, meaning computers, consumer electronics, manufacturing goods, things that will help them with their education. Now, they didn't go as far as to say they should get a salary. But there is a case out of California that says they are entitled to a salary, and somehow or another, I think that's going to find its way as the next step in front of SCOTUS. Will this change college football as we know it, college basketball? I don't think it's going to affect field hockey. I don't think it's going to affect lacrosse or track and field. But it will affect football and basketball, big money makers. And are these players now going to take the next step and say the NBA and the NFL have no right to say they can't play there as long as they're 18 years old? Why would I go to college and get hurt? I'm good enough to play there now. The key here is that the NFL loves the college system. It's their minor league. And it's free. It doesn't cost them anything. They just sit and watch the colleges develop players for them. The system sucks. The days of football and other athletics being strictly, scholar athletes?
Yeah. Student athletes, right.
Well, guess what? Yeah, guess what? No. But this is an upheaval within college athletics that I don't know, you know, it just goes along with what the women are complaining about every step of the way at every single national championship. They're complaining, why are our facilities different? Why are our schedules different? Why are we beaten up where the men aren't beaten up? Excuse me. So this is a volcanic eruption in college athletics. And it's basically the Constitution saying, okay, and antitrust law is saying, no, you're not going to do this to these young people anymore. I'm sorry, Nick Saban. We know you make $11 million a year, even though you are one of the, excuse my French, one of the great assholes walking the face of the earth. But you're through making $11 million on the back of college athletes. I think we're going to take some of your money away and give it to them. Does that sound fair to you? But we'll let you keep the statue outside the stadium. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I don't know what the NCAA does, because I think you're right. I think we're heading down that path of saying these players can be paid. Then the question is, do they somehow try to equalize the amount players are paid at each school, or they just unleash this so that there's no more recruiting. There's just the offer, right, the financial offer. So a student's not choosing between Ohio State and Michigan. There's no choice. If Michigan is paying them, a couple hundred grand.
Oh, there never was a choice to play between Ohio State and Michigan. It was always Ohio State.
Yeah, right. Yeah. All right, that's
the
wrong example.
You can tell by the 10 straight games we've won.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let me change this to Duke and North Carolina so we can get out of the Ohio State conversation. Right.
Thank you for that one. I appreciate it. That was a great setup.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank
I just teed it up. Teed it up for you. Good.
Okay. One last thing that you wanted to talk about. I'll open the floor to you on Biden and the Catholic Church.
Yeah. This is just something that's in the news. And I grew up Catholic. This strikes me as extremely odd that there would be a group of conservative bishops who would come together and try to deny the President of the United States communion because of a political position that he's taken with regard to reproductive rights. I saw an interesting, I don't know if it was a tweet.
Can I stop you there before you get into it? Biden's position on reproductive rights is, I am personally against abortion,
right,
but I'm in favor of a woman's right to choose. So let's make that clear. Okay.
Yeah, that's it. And I know there's a lot of people like that who say in my own personal life I would have a problem with it. But it's really a matter of jurisdiction, right? I mean, who makes the decision? Does the state have jurisdiction, or does the woman have jurisdiction over that that choice? And so that's his opinion is simply that the woman has jurisdiction to make that choice, whether he agrees with it or not. The question I have is, if you're going to say that that Joe Biden has committed the kind of sin that would warrant him being excluded from receiving communion, did Joe Biden have an abortion? I must have missed that. I must have missed it.
No, not that I heard.
Not
since the sex change operation. Okay.
This is unbelievable to me. I mean, so. When did the rule become that you can't receive communion if you have thought through an issue politically and taken a stance politically that does not mesh right with your own personal beliefs and the church's teaching? So now it's the thought police. If we're going to go down this road, and as we talked about it earlier, then we really need to, you know, in addition to reevaluating how we pay student athletes, we also need to reevaluate the tax exempt status of certain religious organizations. So you can take it from there.
To involve
you agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we talked about earlier, the purpose of the First Amendment was to provide for freedom of religion, not freedom of wealth. Freedom of speech, agreed. But you have a tax exempt status, and yet you still attempt to interfere in the body politic over issues that, although they don't agree, you have the right to say, I don't agree with that, but you don't have the right to punish people and try to coerce people into voting a certain way. If you're going to become an arm of politics, become, for all intents and purposes, a PAC,
mm-hmm.
then you should be taxed. Okay? Because you're making billions and billions and billions of dollars off of the people. You're probably the largest landowners in the world, and yet you sit there tax-free accumulating wealth. And that's just not what it was intended to be. So if you want to do these things, then you can pay a tax, because now as a taxpayer, you have the right to complain. Otherwise, don't complain. I just see a real problem with all of this.
Yeah.
On that note, we're going to have to close the hour, because our next guest is on. Just exciting. Well,
okay.
I guess I'm glad I didn't become a football player. Was the wrong time.
I got to ask you, if I can, just one thing. I got an email from someone who we both know. His name is Tyler, who said that we forgot to mention that the idea of a tax or a penalty was the idea of the Republicans in hopes that the scheme would get thrown out as a penalty, not a tax, in order to also try to get people to not buy into the ACA and just pay the penalty. It was their idea.
Right.
Oh.
So we'll leave it at that.
Fascinating.
But I thought I would
All
add
right.
that. So that's for you, Tyler. Okay.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Enjoy.
We'll speak to you next week.
We'll see you next
All the
week,
best
okay?
To you.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Talk
Have a good
to
week.
You, talk
Bye.
To you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye,
friend.
Bye. Okay. Well, let's go on to our next guest, who is none other than Carlos Burgos. And he is a candidate for the Yonkers City Council, District 4. So good morning, Mr. Burgos. Thanks for you know, hanging in there for a moment or two after they encroached on your time. But we got time at the
That's
other end.
That's all right. That's
How
all right. It gave me some time to transition from the campaign trail or whatever this is, this election day trail. I'm doing well. It's been an interesting morning. But one full of some great reminders of what this campaign is all about, you know, and why I sort of began this thing. So I'm feeling really good today, which is, you know, probably the way we should
That's really the gist of what I wanted to talk to you about is, like, what have you learned on the campaign trail, and does it actually connect with your thinking and also with the public perception of who you are? Because I think in the time that you've been campaigning, people have got to know you a little bit better, and
right.
you know, it can make a big difference.
Sure. No, we can only know, you know, so much about perception, you know, but what I know
right.
is I get the sense that people generally can tell if someone's being authentic, you know, and especially when you're in person. It's a little harder to do that virtually. We've all learned that over the past year and a half, but in person,
right.
or I guess it's running on, what, 2 years now? Gosh, it's been so long. But in person, you know, people have been able to sort of experience me, I think, as, you know, as authentic as I come, and I love that, and it's showing today, and it showed a little bit during early voting, because, you know, less people come out during early voting, but people really, you can tell when someone is being themselves, when they're being honest, when they're being genuine, and I think that at the core of why I'm doing this, because I think people like that, like me, should be in office. We should be, you know, serving people. And we should have our, you know, we should have people who are representing us with us in mind. And so people know that. People
well, how do you define, how do you,
think,
how do you,
yeah.
well, how do you define who you are that aren't represented in the 4th District, for example? what's the
sure
message?
Yeah, no, yeah, that's a good frame. I think generally there's this idea that politicians are a bit disconnected, and so it might not be it is sort of like a larger thing for sure. But we know in our district that my council person has not been responsive. I probably say that every time we get on this radio show. But, we know that people know that when they call me, I'll pick up or I'll call back. And, obviously I can't pick up all the time. I mean, that's just the way it is. But they know that they'll get a call back or a text back or an email back. And that, I think just that alone is a great, distinction that people have been, that I've been received well for. So politicians as being disconnected, and our certainly our council person as being a disconnected person is one, but having different interests in mind is another thing, right? I think people have a strong sense that my council person is invested in the other side of the city, both financially and do his business on the other side, but also just given like the legislation that he supports, affordable housing being the big one that's on the table right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't support that at all. And, the questions are, well, why, how could you not support affordable housing? And that is another sort of way that people, I think about.
But do people understand the whole issue of affordable housing? I think in Yonkers, it's only 10% is permitted. There is talk of trying to increase it to 20, but it seems just talk at the moment because it doesn't seem to be a concept that's being, inculcated by the other membership of the city council or by all seven.
Well, yeah,
who's for it.
Well, it seems pretty, people have been pretty clear about their stance. I mean, we know that, I'll only speak with my seat, our District 4 council seat. He pledged publicly to vote no on that, and to keep it, to not vote for 20% affordable housing units to be required in new large developments in the city. So that's the piece of legislation that's on the table. It's a bill that's written up. I mean, all they have to do is vote on it at this point, and it's being dragged mm-hmm. along through the campaign season at the very least.
But that's what I got to ask you. Do people understand why it makes sense to increase the affordable housing component in a building from 10 to 20? Why is that so difficult, or is that part of a political dogma?
What people's understanding of? I think people understand that affordable housing matters, especially people who mm-hmm. can't afford where they live, especially those folks. But
right.
even, District 4 is full of very nice homes, and I spend a lot of time knocking on those nice homes' doors, and even they understand, we're doing well, we live in a great place, but we think other people should be able to afford where they live. I mean, that's a common mm-hmm. Response I get on doors.
Right.
And so it's not just, thankfully, it's not just the people who need it. It's the people who, want others to experience, dignified housing, so I think people understand. I think people probably aren't as looped into the internal political nonsense that we have to be, but they understand at the basic mm-hmm. level we need more affordable housing, and 20% is not enough, and how do we get more? And so that's, I'm excited by that, and I'm energized by that.
Well, that is very interesting. I haven't heard as much talk about affordable housing for many years, so I was surprised that it came back on the front burner. And I think it's encouraging because we have a large population of people who are not earning enough to be able to afford an apartment, certainly not at
right.
market rates. And
absolutely.
And it's interesting as well that a lot of people who are moving into market rate housing actually are not really moving into market rate housing, and a lot of the stuff that was built in the last 10 years that was supposed to be market rate are languishing, and they've now become Section 8 housing all along
right,
the waterfront.
Right.
And
nobody can afford
people don't discuss
market rate.
That. Exactly. So it's very interesting how that's working out. What other issues have become pertinent, or that people that when you go around in your campaign effort, you found that was important to them that has not been recognized or espoused by the present candidate or the present city councilman?
Sure. Yeah. No. I mean, and these are luckily it's well. Luckily and unfortunately, it's pretty consistent. You know, that's I say luckily, but maybe that's a misstep on my part. Unfortunately, it's very consistent. So many of the things that we said in our first conversation still ring true after however many hundred more doors I've knocked on and hundreds of more people I've met. So these streets that we've all memorized the potholes on, you know, that's the way that I'm sort of thinking about it
right now.
But there's a bunch of different ways people talk about the memorized potholes or the streets that we just avoid so that we don't have to repair our car after. This stuff is, you know, not something that people have been silent about, and it's something that obviously it takes more than just a council person to fix. It takes, you know, the city to do, and there's, you know, various departments involved. The mayor needs to help out with that and all sorts of things. But
isn't that the role of the city council people? They have two roles. One is to approve legislation or disapprove legislation. Another is to be the sounding board and the purveyors of sensitivity and sensibility to issues from a community. And they have to espouse that, or at least give it voice.
The last role is to manage the budget. But go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, of course. But those are the three components, aren't they?
I agree.
A lot
That's
of people are languishing on that.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, yes. That's why I'm spending all my time developing what I keep calling this responsive platform, because it allows me the flexibility to like you said, sort of take in what another way to think about it is me being sort of a conduit of the constituents, right? Like me sort of taking in and then elevating the voice in the council, elevating the issues in the council. And so that's what I see the role as.
Have we forgotten that? Why have we forgotten that? That used to be the rationale. Whether you were on the local city council or whether you were a senator or you were a congressman, that's the job. Why have we lost our way?
The only thing I can think of, and who knows, really, we're speculating at this point, but that there is a whole career of politicians. You know, they call them career politicians. There's a whole career to be made if you want that to be your life, and you can easily lose sight of the constituents and pay more attention to the donors and pay more attention to who's going to fund your next reelection campaign and things like that. And generally, those are businesses, industries, you know, corporations, PACs, things like that, which you all know, you know. But that's my only sense, is people really want to, you know, get reelected, and they figure the way to do that is to focus on them. My sense is the best way to get reelected is to continue focusing on the constituents. So that's what I'll be doing, because the constituents vote, and that's who I
want
to talk to anyway. So,
have we forgotten that people have a choice, and that their choice is to vote one way or another, or a third, or a fourth, or a fifth way? Why are we blaming the system when we either don't go to vote or we vote for people over and over and over again who don't comply with our interests or don't conform to our interests or don't explain to us why they don't buy our concern, or if it's already been mitigated and they may not even realize it? Where's the disconnect in our system? Have we failed in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years? Or are we getting better at what we're doing?
What I know and I'll try to speak about my campaign experience. You know, a lot of well, what I know is my current council person, the person I'm going against, he's running as the incumbent candidate, and he tried really hard, or his campaign, someone magically, we don't actually know technically who, but there were some forces involved that were involved in aggressively trying to have no option, trying to give voters in this district no option. And they do that by knocking people off the ballot. That's sort of the lay term, but, you know, it means, you know, getting essentially making sure that there is no competition. And so what does a voter do when there's so much of that happening, right? So that's one thing I'm thinking about with your question. And the next thing I'm thinking about is, you know, how disappointed people are when they see their options. You know, I think one thing that I've experienced with so much joy is being out in, you know, on the street in a neighborhood and people telling me, hey, you know, you seem like a nice guy. You seem different. You know, you really seem like you're genuine. And what usually, what sometimes follows that is, you know, you're going to become corrupt, right? Or I hope you stay in, you know. And I think what happens is people are, you know, disappointed in their options. And so they're like, no, I don't want to vote for another of the same thing again. So they just opt out, you know. And then we end up with people who benefit from that, which are obviously more often the ones who are incumbents and have, you know, have the sort of career politics.
Well,
I've
got to ask you, like, when you think about your moving, where you're conceivably getting elected into office, representing the district, do you feel that you're, you don't have the backbone to sustain your credibility and your integrity in political office? Is it that difficult to do? I know that everybody's looking for funding. Is it impossible not to taint oneself once in politics? I know there was one candidate years ago. She ran on the position that she would only be there for one term. And she said that if she can't accomplish everything that she needs to accomplish in 4 years, that there was no reason to continue, which I resented that was her final decision, but I had to respect the fact that she promised that to her constituents, and that meant that was her integrity, and I had to accept it. But I thought she was brilliant, and still do, and so necessary. But unfortunately, maybe it was a quagmire that she fell into. And she made a promise that she knew that she had to keep, or felt she had to keep, and she didn't want to go back on her word. And I think that's part of her integrity. But is it that difficult to stay engaged and even to make a career of politics if you represent the people that you're supposed to be representing?
I have no intention in changing my positions or becoming sucked up by some sort of mysterious power that we're trying to describe. But I imagine that, you know, some people are better positioned to resist those urges than others. You know, I think I have options outside of politics. You know, I don't come from a family of politicians. I am very happily, you know, employed outside of this political space. I'm very employable, you know, and I think that may not be the case for other folks. And I think that may have an impact on,
if you have a position and you are employed, there isn't that much time necessary, you know, to reach out to the community, especially if they vote for you the first time. And because you've already connected with them, and the idea is just to follow that up. There are times when you're not working where you can reach out to the community as well. Like, so simple. And there are places
to me as well.
To get together. Yeah. I don't know why we made it so difficult, though. For some people, it seems like they're so oblivious to what's going on in a community, I really wonder why people are voting them back in. Is it just simple name recognition?
Yeah, I suppose. I think that, you know, sometimes I think there's probably so many different factors, you know. But who knows? I mean, what I know is that I plan on doing exactly what you said, you know, following up. I mean, we'll have a really great time reconnecting and actually getting some things done in the district, you know, in a few months.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that energizes me. It excites me to think about lamp posts, you know, it excites me to think about things that people actually, that they care about. And I think the thing about a local race is, or rather a local race at this level, you know, city council in a city like Yonkers, is that name recognition really doesn't carry, right? It just really doesn't. We like to think it does, but it really doesn't. People don't know their council person. People don't, you know, for the most part, people don't. And so it really is about some other force, you know, whether that's like a really well-funded campaign, whether that's a bunch of other people, you know, some great political insiders helping out or things like that, strong sort of politically active base. Maybe it's, you know, a great union that got behind a candidate or so, you know, so those sorts of things really, I think, matter at the local level. The other thing that really matters for local races like this is getting in front of people and you know, knocking on the doors. And that's where I've been most successful, I think, is like really spending the time. I mean, it's a lot of time and it's a lot of willpower and it's emotionally draining to be what I've been describing this as, you know, when I walk for 5 or 6 hours a day, I'm in a job interview that I'm outside in the heat for. And I'm constantly in a job interview for 6 hours straight, walking around, knocking on in people's personal homes, you know. And that's just that takes a toll on you. So you
it
have
does.
To, you know. Anyways, but that stuff really matters. That stuff really matters at the local level. And we'll see in the next few hours, hopefully, if we can get some results from the polls, we'll see, you know, what pans out.
Well, however the poll results come about, you'll either become the city council person or you might be defeated. But in case you get defeated, is there enough interest in you to continue to work for political office, especially in the district you want to represent? It's very conceivable that, you know, your opponent may not be running for office. He, you know, who knows what exactly he wants to do, but does it take more than one time at the political effort to win a seat and to maintain your interest in the community? Is that what's important? I don't know. I've never run in a campaign, so I don't know how much effort you have to put into it. You're putting in a lot of time already. Yeah, a lot.
Sure, right on. I think that one of the reasons why I decided to jump into this race was because I think that this is a way that I can have a positive impact on my community, you know. And I think there are a lot of different ways that I can do that, you know. And so I think this is one way. And so what I'll say is, if there are other ways that I think I can have a positive impact, a real impact, then I'll consider them, you know, but we'll see, you know, we will see. I think I don't like to really waste my time. I like to be intentional with where I put my time and have it have an impact. So, you know, we all do, hopefully. You know, so we'll see. We'll see. I hate to think about whether I win or lose this early on, you know, it's, even though it's not that early, it's the end of the last day, but, you know, we still have some time. So I dare not, you know, begin to think about tomorrow.
I don't know what the outcome will be. I've no idea. So I haven't seen very much from your opponent since, you know, he decided to run again. But I just haven't seen it. So I don't know what he's doing. But it doesn't matter. You know, if you don't want to reach out, then you don't reach out. That's all. So mm-hmm. I don't know mm-hmm. what his campaign is like, and that's up to him. It's not up to me. But your campaign seems to be very much engaged, and you're out there. So that's really very telling. I think it matters. A lot of issues just haven't been contended with in the district, whether it be seniors and the senior center and the dog park
sure.
and the potholes in the streets. And so who's advocating for the 4th district?
Me. I am.
Okay.
That's the point. That's
well, good
the point.
For you.
And
thank
you know,
God
I'm
for that.
Super excited about that. Yeah, no, and I'm genuinely doing it, which is what counts. You know, I'm not going to sit here and,
yeah.
you know, who knows what barriers will come, but we know, I think people know, and if they don't know, they should know that I'm committed to doing that work on the council. So,
mm-hmm.
but right.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had a lot of things that have not been, they sort of, you know, they were hot for a second and then they sort of got to the back burner, which is not, it's just not acceptable. You know, we need
yeah.
someone who's very, who takes this stuff seriously. These are real people in our city. These are our neighbors, you know, for crying out loud, you know. And
exactly.
I couldn't walk down the street, you know, after being elected without taking this work, you know, with the utmost, you know, seriousness, dare I use that word again,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
So, yep.
I concur. I mean, if you don't love what you're doing, if you don't want to represent people in the best way possible, that you recognize your own capacity, you know, I would never want to, you know, I'm not going to be a football hero because I don't have that capacity. I would never even think of considering it. But, you know, I guess if I was 50 years younger, I might consider, now that I know so much about politics, I would consider running. But you also,
right.
you know, Yonkers is a very interesting place. It's not, you know, if you're not born here or if you aren't here at a very young age and you don't go to school with all the people that you're in school with and you don't know them, then you become a carpetbagger, you know, so...
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of personal relationships that are grown here, and
mm-hmm.
it's a very small town, and yet it's the third or fourth largest city in the state.
Yes,
we got
yes.
over 200,000 people easily. I don't think the census is on target, but whatever. So, but you seem to be very confident about, you know, your effort and your focus and people are talking to you. So they're not hiding and they're sharing their thoughts. So are all those things the most important thing, the senior center, the dog park, the state of the roads? What are the things that are important? That's
yeah,
enough,
we have,
though,
you know, there's
to be
a group of folks.
With you.
Of course, right? No, that's where we start. We have a group of folks who are heavily invested in, you know, our animals, you know, our pets in our community.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been in conversation with them about a spay-neuter clinic, which wouldn't be in our district, but
mm-hmm.
would be, you know, our city is small enough where we can, you know, we can work across districts a little bit when we're trying to do some good. So I'm interested in, you know, we have veterinarians in the city who want to do the work. We have people who are very passionate. We have pets that need the work. So that's a big, that's another.
Can't you even do that? Can't you even do that like on a truck where you can visit
you probably
once
could,
a month
yeah.
or whatever?
Sure. We probably
you know,
could do that. I think if there was a will, we
yeah.
could figure it out.
Absolutely. Well, that's the issue. A lot of people don't bring up concerns, so we don't know what's important.
Sure.
And
well,
and then they drop the ball because they don't even know all the issues. And the other thing is, like, for example, you filed for the money that you took in for your campaign, and others
sure.
haven't done that. Like your opposition hasn't
right.
done that. Why are some people
right.
permitted to skirt the law and others abide by the law? I never understood that, and I thought it would never
well,
happen. on such a large scale, you know, because so many people haven't filed their returns.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we know, I mean, you have some legal professors on before me, so they could probably answer this question better, but we know the law in the United States has always been, just been malleable enough to work for some people and not work for others, right? Like, it's just the law in the United States has historically been structured that way. And it's rewritten and amended and changed and, you know, contorted in all sorts of ways to help certain people.
Yeah. Contorted is a great word.
Right. So, you know, we see that historically, and I guess I'm talking a little bit more federal, but it trickles down into the local level, and it trickles down to the state. You're talking state finance level, you know, and so that's why it's hard for me to put too much faith in that and just really understand. It's helpful. It's more helpful for me living in my own body, you know, to understand that reality and then work efficiently, right? I know that I cannot get away with not filing, you know, and so I file.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine a world where I didn't file, you know. That's my reality. That's what I know. That's how I understand my relationship to the law. And
absolutely.
And some people don't have that relationship to the law. Some people can, you know, get away with a whole bunch of things without any repercussions, and that's their relationship to the law, and unfortunately we have, you know, we don't yet have a legal system that is you know, fair or equitable, so we
that's
have to
true.
That's work
well
within
said.
It. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, how do you know? Well, people are still going out to vote. It's a little bit early. It's not the end of the day, but it's certainly it's getting hotter. So I guess a lot of people are voting early. And there weren't a lot of voting. I don't think a lot of voting took place before, you know, as absentee ballots or handicapped people who couldn't attend.
Sure.
Like I was afraid that there would be such a long line at the polling station today that I filed an absentee ballot and went to the post office, which isn't that far away, and in order to mail it. And so this way I knew it was sent in and that would be okay. But I was in no condition to be waiting 6 hours online. I don't think I would have been able to handle that. So
it doesn't seem to be that way this time around, which is
But a lot of people didn't vote early. It seems so. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to turn out.
I don't know either.
It's gonna. This is we haven't reached a crescendo yet, so we don't know where it's going. We'll have to see what happens at the end of the day. There'll be pundits all over the place trying to figure this out. I would rather they would be analysts rather than pundits. But let's hope we got some analysts who could do this.
That's funny.
Well, do you think it's important for people to still know how to get to your website just in case they're not familiar with you?
Sure. My website is still up and running, and it'll be up and running. It's carlos4yonkers.com. That's the number 4, not the word 4. So carlos4yonkers.com. And if people want to give me a call, feel free. I got a call last night around 8 o'clock to talk, to try to get to know me, and I'll take those throughout the day. My number is 914-294-4769. So you can feel free to give me a shout. I'm running around like a crazy person, so I may miss the call, but I'll call you back if we miss. And we'll talk if we don't see each other at the polls. I'm excited to see a bunch of people. So this
absolutely.
Is it.
Absolutely. Very, very encouraging. Well, I wish you all the best. I'm glad that you made the time for me and made time for our listeners. And I hope it was worth your while. Thank you very much.
Eddie.
I appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. Carlos Burgos. He's running as a candidate for Yonkers City Council District 4. And today is primary day. So he's facing off against the incumbent, and the incumbent is facing off against him. So those are the two candidates running for to gain the vote of the residents of the 4th District. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how this comes about. And let's hope for the best. The best is whatever is good for the district. And that's for individuals to decide. And we'll go from there. All right. Well, let's look at some other things that are interesting. I want you to go back 80 years ago, and because it's important. I think it's important. I hope you'll care to listen to it. It's called Hitler's War of Annihilation. It was called Operation Barbarossa, and it is 80 years ago. Perhaps the most pivotal moment in the Second World War took place on June 22, 1941, when Nazi Germany launched its invasion of the Soviet Union, shocking the world and striking fear into Joseph Stalin's heart, but sowing the seeds of Adolf Hitler's downfall. Well, one of the most striking eyewitness testimonies from the extraordinary outburst of militarized violence in which some 5 million people were killed in 200 days comes from German soldier Alexander Korff. He writes, "Two villages were burning in front of us. Civilians were completely taken by surprise. They didn't have time to flee. The most horrific images was a 3-year-old child lying in the middle of the road with half its head missing." Barbarossa shattered the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact between Nazi Germany and the USSR, signed in August of 1939. Stalin was shocked he had received a plethora of warnings of an imminent invasion, notably from Winston Churchill. Informed by British intelligence briefings, the communist dictator had refused to believe them. "It's got to be a provocation from the German generals," he told these senior Soviet officials in the early hours of June 22. "I'm sure Hitler isn't aware of this." Well, Hitler felt the need to act 1 year to one day to the day after the French armistice because his previous strategy to knock the UK out of the war had failed. After the Royal Air Force defeated the Luftwaffe in the 1940 Battle of Britain, and Churchill had made it clear that the UK would remain a thorn in Hitler's side, the Nazi dictator turned his attention to the USSR. And I'm trying to remember now, a scientist who actually invented or was able to come up with the Enigma code, to break the Enigma code that the Nazis were using. For 2 solid years, the Enigma code was presented to every conceivable formation of military, air and sea and land, through the Enigma code. It was never found out. And then I'm trying to think now what his name was. He broke the Enigma code with a group of other people. I think his name was Tuborg or something like that. I don't remember now, but he actually was able to recognize, once they did break the code, which ended up was broken because they recognized that there was some, they were trying to break it out from beginning to end, which didn't work. So then they said, but there've got to be some letters there that would work out through the Enigma code. And what they did was they put in, somebody said the most important thing in Germany was Heil Hitler. So actually they put in Heil Hitler into their computer system, and it worked. And it worked so well that they were able to decipher code after code after code. But then the guy who actually broke the code with his compatriots said, we cannot do anything about this. We cannot tell anybody in advance. The military must not be allowed to reveal this. And he spoke to the military, and they agreed. So a lot of things would continue. However, there were other times when the Germans never realized what was happening because the Brits had already broken the code, and they were able to figure out what to do in advance, but never so blatant that the Nazis had figured out what was going on and or that the code was broken. And so this was brilliant. And the guy was the precursor of the computer system. And unfortunately, he died. He was gay. Being gay was illegal in Britain at that time. And they gave him some sort of drug to, what's the term? I'm losing my mind. To take away his fertility, I think. And so he actually died from this medication that destroyed his testosterone level. And so he died from that. But brilliant, brilliant guy, fascinating story. And that's how the Enigma code was broken by a British scientist who actually is the beginning of our computer age. And the Nazis never knew about it. And that's why in this story, when it was Winston Churchill that informed Stalin in his British intelligence briefings that Stalin never knew how Winston Churchill would know, but he did. And that's because the Enigma code had been broken. And that was one of the things that was put in the Enigma code. Anyway, Hitler felt the need to act 1 year to the day after the French armistice because his previous strategy to knock the UK out of the war had failed, and the Royal Air Force defeated the Luftwaffe in the 1940 Battle of Britain, and Churchill had made it clear that the United Kingdom would remain a thorn in Hitler's side. The Nazi dictator turned his attention to the USSR. Britain remaining in the war after the fall of France effectively tore up Hitler's strategy, so he had to devise a new plan, conquering the USSR to achieve his dream of German Lebensraum, which is living room, explained Jean Lopez, a co-author of Barbarossa, 1941, La Guerre Absolue. So the absolute war. Hitler had already expounded upon his concept of German living space, or Lebensraum, carved out in Eastern Europe in Mein Kampf, but his failure to defeat Britain gave it a new impetus. Quote, he wanted to use Lebensraum so he could successfully wage a long war against the United Kingdom and the United States because the Third Reich did not have enough resources without seizing those of the USSR, Lopez had put it. Now, more immediate geostrategic considerations in Eastern Europe also motivated Hitler, noted Richard Overy, professor of history at Exeter University and the author of numerous books on the Second World War, including Russia's War. Quote, Soviet expansion into the Baltic states, Romania, and Poland, followed by a request in November of 1940 for influence in Bulgaria and the Turkish Straits, made it clear to Hitler that Stalin posed a serious strategic threat, which had to be eliminated, Overy had said. Now, the Soviet Union was also the home of Jewish Bolshevism, a conspiracist canard at the heart of Nazi ideology, so that defeating Soviet forces would also eliminate the threat from communism hanging over Germany and Europe. Overy continued, and Hitler used a cocktail of motives, quote, at various points to, quote, convince himself of the necessity and justice of war, end quote. Well, surprising, their enemy played to the Nazis' advantage as a flabbergasted Stalin floundered, quote, he spent a few hours hesitating, wondering if it was a real invasion, an attempt to force negotiations, or a mere provocation, end quote, Lopez recounted. Consequently, Soviet forces suffered colossal losses, while the Wehrmacht, the German military, tore into the USSR. Millions of soldiers were surrounded, stripped of supplies, and forced to surrender. The Stalinist regime also menaced Soviet troops. The fearsome secret police, the NKVD, was ordered to shoot dead any soldier suspected of cowardice, while people suspected of lacking patriotism were sent away for forced labor. Well, conditions on the front line were brutal, as 10 million men, 30,000 planes, and 25,000 tanks clashed in a gigantic fight to the death. Fanatics would shoot at us until the roofs collapsed over their heads and buried them in rubble, German soldier Hans Rothe had remembered the fighting in Ukraine. It is a myth that the Wehrmacht was rampantly successful until the famous turning point at Stalingrad from August of 1942 till February of 1943. Overy said, quote, the Red Army was poorly prepared at the frontier, and it proved very difficult to establish a solid or coordinated line of defense. Important tactical and technical differences maximize the impact of the German attack. For example, Soviet aircraft and tanks lacked radio communication. Infantry tactics were also inept in 1941 and improved only later. German forces, however, soon ran into logistical difficulties, had to spend much time clearing up pockets of resistance from bypassed Red Army soldiers, and suffered from strategic confusion at Hitler's headquarters. Overy continued, there was enough of a difference to bring big early victories, but by November/December, the hope for victory in a few weeks or months was completely dashed, and the momentum was never recovered. There wasn't a turning point as such, rather a continuing process of wear and tear ground the Wehrmacht down, Lopez had added. Well, Barbarossa failed because of fierce resistance from an enemy Nazi ideology had misleadingly cast as inherently weaker, as well as the logistical difficulties of invading Russia's vast territories, especially in winter, the same problem that had cursed Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion in 1812. But the Nazis' cruelty to local populations also undermined Barbarossa. Some people in occupied territories greeted the Wehrmacht as liberators from Soviet oppression. But this was soon revealed to be an illusion. German forces' brutality against civilians became part of daily life. Millions of Soviet prisoners of war died because of horrific conditions in death marches from the front line and in forced labor camps. Quote, Hitler launched a war of annihilation, end quote, said Marie Moutier-Bitain, a historian specializing in the Holocaust and author of Le Champ de la Shoah, or chief, the chief of the German Armed Forces High Command, Wilhelm Keitel, signed a decree on May 13 of 1941, granting preventive amnesty for all officers, or rather all crimes allegedly committed by German soldiers against civilians in Soviet territory. And this decree also gave army officers the freedom to launch campaigns of reprisal and repression against civilians in response to the slightest suspicion without any prior investigation. Operation Barbarossa marked a new stage in the Holocaust as Jews were the prime target for German soldiers. Mass killings, pogroms, and the Holocaust by bullets gathered pace during the invasion, Moutier Bitan recounted. The SS Einsatzgruppen were tasked with eliminating the Nazis' political opponents and Jews suspected of supporting the Soviet regime, but soon they started shooting large sections of the Jewish population. More than 500,000 Jews were murdered between June 22 and the end of 1941 on territory captured in Operation Barbarossa. Invading the USSR was just the very beginning of the end for Hitler. While Barbarossa was the act of hubris leading to the nemesis that brought down Nazism, the tide only turned decisively against Hitler when the USSR triumphed at Stalingrad amid unspeakable conditions and the British smashed Erwin Rommel's forces at El Alamein in November of 1942. Even after those Allied victories, it was more than 2.5 years of death and suffering before the Soviet soldiers raised the red flag over the Reichstag, the parliament surrounded by the smoke and ruins of an exhausted, defeated Berlin. Unbelievable. So, you know, what can I tell you? I think it was pertinent to know that history because there are lessons to be learned for sure. Now, this is really mind-boggling. I don't know if it's such a big to-do, but evidently hits the press. Raiders Nassib comes out on Instagram, becomes the first publicly gay NFL player. Well, Las Vegas Raiders defensive and Carl Nassib said on Monday he was gay, making him the first active National Football League player to come out publicly. Quote, "I just wanted to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay," Nassib, 28, said in a video he posted to Instagram. Quote, "I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest," he said. Nassib added, quote, "I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important," end quote. Continuing, he said, "I hope that one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. In an effort to cultivate a more accepting and compassionate culture," he said he was donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project, a suicide prevention service for LGBT plus youth in the United States. Nassib played at Penn State before being drafted by the Cleveland Browns in the third round of the 2016 draft. He played in the for the Browns and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers before signing with the Raiders ahead of the 2020 session. Well, I'm glad that he found the strength to do that because I'm sure that's a burden when you don't say so. Interestingly enough, Italy's health ministry has lifted outdoor mask wearing restrictions. Well, mask wearing outdoors in Italy will no longer be required in virtually all of the country starting on June 28, right around the corner. Health Minister Roberto Speranza tweeted on Monday night that the mask requirement will be eliminated in those parts of Italy in designated white zone regions where, COVID-19 case incidence is low and ICU admissions of the illness are below thresholds considered at risk for overwhelming hospitals. Currently, all but one small region in northwest Italy have white zone designations. Masks will still be required to be worn on public transport and as well as indoors. Nearly 30% of people in Italy 12 or older have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. So we'll have to see where all that goes and see how well they do there. Interestingly enough, we've been following the elections in Peru. A judge has rejected a request to detain Peruvian presidential hopeful Fujimori. Well, a Peruvian judge on Monday dismissed a prosecutor's request for corruption-accused presidential hopeful Keiko Fujimori to be returned to preventive detention, even as the country awaits the outcome of the June 6th election in which she is vying for the top job. Now, Judge Victor Zuniga ruled, quote, unfounded, quote, unquote, a request for by prosecutor Jose Domingo Perez for Fujimori's parole to be rescinded after she allegedly met a witness in her trial in violation of the conditions for her provisional freedom. Fujimori, who narrowly trails leftist rival Pedro Castillo, according to the unconfirmed vote count, risks an imminent corruption trial if she loses the race. She has already spent 16 months in pretrial detention and was freed in May last year due to the coronavirus outbreak. She was barred from leaving Peru or communicating with co-defendants or witnesses in the case. On June 11, prosecutor Jose Domingo Perez asked, quote, an organized crime court to order Fujimori's return to custody for allegedly having met a witness, so violating the conditions of her provisional freedom. So that was the story there. And one second. I think that's it. Well, tomorrow is Wednesday. So let me see. Wednesday, we're going to have, I have to see if I can get this for you. Tomorrow is Wednesday. So let's see who we have. We're going to speak to David Rubin in Israel. He's the mayor, the former mayor of Shiloh. We're going to speak to Joni Madden. You're going to be loving her, just phenomenal. And we're going to speak to Sean Patterson Howard. So I hope you'll join us, Daniel. It'll be a fascinating show. All the best to you, and thank you again. Goodbye.